Hello, fellow foodies, and welcome back. This is Dr. Cassandra Quave, the host of Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious. Today on the show, I'm going to talk about something really special, near and dear to my heart, and that is the topic of University Herbaria. I became the curator of the Emory University Herbarium back in 2012. And so 12 years later, I have seen this collection thrive and grow, but we also face some serious challenges, and we're not the only ones. So for this episode, I want to talk a little bit about what an herbarium is, where we can find them, what utility they have for research, and also add in a couple of excerpts from other scholars who have commented on this as well. A lot of this was really stimulated by an alarming announcement that came out last month from Duke University. You see, their dean had announced that they have decided to close their collection of really over 825,000 specimens of plants, bryophytes, and fungi that have been in this historic collection, which dates back to over a century. So scientists are alarmed, scholars are alarmed, because we need these collections to not only do research of today, but we need these collections for the research of tomorrow. Herbaria are defined as a natural history museum. And this is no greenhouse. If you've ever wondered what an herbarium looks like, you can think of, imagine a room filled with metal cabinets. And within each of these cabinets, there are shelves upon shelves of pressed plants pasted to paper. So these sheets of paper are roughly the size of a newspaper in terms of height. They are acid-free paper. And when botanists go out in the field to collect plants, we take a specimen that is, you know, roughly the size of kind of from our elbow to the tips of our finger. And those specimens need to have fruits or flowers and leaves. And this is how we identify life. This is why herbaria have also been described as libraries of life on Earth. So what are they used for? Well, number one, these collections are essential to our ability to track and name life forms, to track and name plants. There are close to 400,000 species of plants, maybe more. The number kind of varies depending upon who's taking that census, but we're still discovering new plants every year. However, we may be losing species faster than we can document them. So I wanted to take a moment today to tell you a little bit about, you know, why it's so critical that we keep these herbaria in universities, and also tell you a bit about the history and what's been happening with collections. So I wrote an article recently, an op-ed or opinion essay for the Washington Post that was released just recently in March, on March 20th. And the title of this article is Scientists Depend on These for Research, Let's Preserve Them. And the whole piece is really about, you know, why do we care about these and why are they important? So I'm going to start by reading this to you. And then I've got a couple of excerpts I'm going to follow up with from other scientists and scholars who have written about this topic in other magazines, including Science Magazine. So here we go. I never meant to become curator of the Emory University Herbarium. It happened by chance 12 years ago. I needed access to an herbarium, a library of plant specimens, and information about them. On that first visit, the herbarium workroom was dusty and filled with old furniture from the biology department. The collection room fared no better. Century-old fragments of plants pasted onto large sheets of paper were stuffed into manila folders, packed too tightly in metal cabinets lined with mercury-dipped felt used as an insect repellent. I took on the role of curator on a voluntary basis. It was made clear to me that there would be no salary, no operational budget. If I wanted to rescue and revitalize the herbarium, I would need to raise the money myself. I wasn't surprised. Despite their vital importance to biodiversity research, herbaria are undervalued and increasingly endangered. An herbarium serves as a natural history museum that scientists depend on for research on climate change, environmental pollution, biodiversity, plant pathology, evolution, ecosystem dynamics, and even the discovery of new foods and drugs. There are about 750 active herbaria in the United States, 490 of them at universities. University herbaria are critical resources for educating the next generation of scientists studying and safeguarding plant life. But over the past 5 years, I've watched 8 herbaria across the country shutter their doors or get packed up and shipped off to another site. In 2017, the closure of a 500,000 specimen herbarium at the University of Louisiana at Monroe required relocation to a non-university research institute in Texas. Most devastatingly, last month, Duke University decided to close its herbarium. A unique collection of 825,000 specimens of algae, bryophytes, lichen, fungi, and plants, the century-old herbarium at Duke is one of the largest in the United States, the second largest among private universities after Harvard's. It is home to an incredibly important collection of organisms from the southeastern United States coastal plains, which is a threatened area rich in biodiverse flora. The reasons that herbaria are being closed are obvious, if flawed. A room full of dead plants that can cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars per year to operate is not nearly as exciting as the latest multi-million dollar microscope or as easy to fund through government grants as a biomedical research. Power in science comes down to money and space. Herbaria require a lot of space, and even though they serve as a kind of library of life on Earth, they bring in little to no grant money. They are often the subject to the resource allocation priorities of a university's leadership at any given time, making them incredibly vulnerable to neglect or divestment. But herbaria are key to biodiversity and humanity's future. Earth is home to an estimated 2.5 million fungi and up to 500,000 types of plants. And we have yet to scientifically describe and name all of them. In the past 3 years, scientists have named more than 8,600 plants as being new to science, and this is according to Britain's Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. Yet even as scientists race to identify, describe, and name species, we are losing many at an alarming pace. Indeed, Kew estimated that 3 in 4 species yet to be described are likely at risk of extinction. Moreover, 45% of all flowering plants are likely at risk of extinction, largely because of human-created pressures such as conversion of lands for agriculture and urban expansion, resource extraction, and climate change. To save biodiversity, we must first document and monitor it to identify what drives species loss and then develop solutions. My work as an ethnobotanist leads me to biodiversity hotspots. These are areas that are biologically rich and yet deeply threatened, and they're found across the globe, where I work with my team and local collaborators and communities to collect plants in the wild, pressing them between sheets of newspaper and drying them so they can be deposited into an herbarium and studied. This is a tried and true process based on techniques that were developed by Italian physician botanist Luca Ghini, who lived in the 1490s to 1550s, and later used by the father of modern taxonomy, Carl Linnaeus, who lived in the 1700s, and the evolutionary biologist Charles Darwin from the 1800s. And so for centuries, naturalists have collected specimens, including foods like black pepper and medicines like fever tree bark that we now take for granted. When they're properly cared for, herbarium specimens can last for centuries. The oldest extant herbarium is held in Rome, and it was prepared nearly 500 years ago. Such specimens provide an incredibly important window into human history, illuminating which plants grew where in the world and when. For example, it's only thanks to herbarium specimens collected in the 1550s from a garden in Pisa, Italy, that we now know what the first European-grown tomatoes were originally sourced from Mexico, what they actually looked like and what their genetic makeup was. Advanced tools in genetics and chemistry are opening up new ways to learn more about our past foods, medicines, and wild plants, and might hold clues for saving future crops from pests, disease, and a changing climate. And imagine what scientists 500 years in the future could do with the specimens we collect and save today. Undoubtedly, many of the species I've collected and curated will no longer exist in nature in the next century, let alone in the next 500 years. These dried fragments of plant tissue might be all that is left for future generations to ponder. Over the past dozen years, I've been thrilled to see the Emory Herbarium grow and once again become a vital resource for botanical research and education on campus. In addition to repairing and annotating specimens, we also brought the collection into the modern era through a digitization program, sharing images and collection data through the Southeast Regional Network of Expertise and Collections, making our herbarium accessible to students and scholars worldwide. This year, the Emory Herbarium celebrates its 75th anniversary. But will it survive another 75 years? The diminishing value placed on university herbaria and taxonomic science threatens the very infrastructure necessary for effective environmental stewardship and the protection of endangered species. Herbaria are not just repositories of historical data. They are the bedrock of environmental conservation efforts. They are nature's last hope in the battle against biodiversity loss and ecosystem collapse. We must do all that we can to save them. So that's the conclusion of my essay with Washington Post. And I really believe this. We have to save these collections because it's only through these resources can we even track the species that are being lost. You know, there's something I often ponder. What happens when the last tree in the forest dies of a certain species? If there's no one there to see that, to make note of it, we're losing treasures beyond our comprehension that we're not going to be able to track. And we're not going to be able to have that physical evidence of those species. And that physical evidence, by the way, is really important to our capacity for mining the chemistry of nature and the genetics of nature that may someday help us fight the next pandemic or may someday help us save a food that may be lost due to pestilence and disease. So there's a lot of value in these collections. I want to read you just a couple of excerpts from other works written by other scholars. This one is a reflection on the closure of the Duke Herbarium by Charles Davis. He is the curator of the plant collection at the Harvard Herbarium in Boston. And the title of his article was "Collections Are Truly Priceless." This was published in Science Magazine. And I'm just going to read one excerpt to really highlight what the trend looks like. "Sadly, Duke is not the first world-class institution to withdraw support from and cease the operation of its natural history collections. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, Princeton and Stanford universities did the same. Ostensibly, the decisions to close those collections were made to shift priority to research programs in molecular biology and biochemistry, which were considered closer to science's cutting edge of discovery and able to attract more external funding. Ironically, nearly half a century on, biological sciences departments at these institutions and comparable ones in China, Brazil, some regions in Africa, and in most of Western Europe are filled with world-class scholars who, knowingly or unknowingly, use herbaria, zoologic collections, and their derivatives every day for transformative research published in the highest impact journals." That was so well said by Dr. Davis. I mean, I think this is something that many in university leadership are missing the point on. The next cutting edge science is being undercut when we remove or displace these collections. We need these collections closer to home, not only to fuel research, but also to fuel the education of our next generation of scientists. If any of you out there listening enjoy going on nature hikes and love to bring along a field guide to have something that kind of, you know, helps you identify plants in the wild, those field guides of your flowers and your trees are only possible due to regional collections of herbaria. Our knowledge of the natural world is only possible due to these collections of herbaria. Here's another piece I want to highlight. This one was written in 2020, again published in Science Magazine. It was titled "Here Today, Gone Tomorrow," and the authors were Dr. Peter Raven and Dr. Scott Miller. And just as a bit of context, they were writing about the alarming loss of biodiversity of plants that we are losing in the wild, not only due to climate change, but also due to, again, conversion of wild ecosystems into agricultural and agricultural lands and construction zones for more human habitats. While we work to forestall this destruction, we must treat the specimens in our collections with ever more care. They are no longer simply samples of wild populations from which more will always be available. As many as half of the specimens likely represent populations that no longer exist, in an increasing number of species as well. What is in our collections will often turn out to be all that remains of organisms that once thrived. Faced with this grave future, we must find ways to preserve these specimens as well as we can for as long as we can. They are vulnerable to degradation and loss from pests, humidity, fire, and the simple ravages of time. While renewing efforts to protect them, we need to make them more accessible through digitization, including imaging and DNA barcoding. We also need to continue targeted sampling focused on key areas, key taxa, and key habitats. So I think this idea of the urgency behind these collections is well established. It's well known that we need to do all that we can to save these specimens. And you may be wondering as a listener, what can I do? I'm not a university professor, perhaps, or I'm not a research scientist. What can I do to help to preserve these? Well, number one, there are opportunities to connect with your local universities and express your support. As I mentioned, there are at least 490 university herbaria spread across the country. And in many cases, these herbaria are incredibly resource limited. In some cases, especially at schools that are land grant institutions, they do have some state funding. But for example, at these private institutions, there's no state funding. I can tell you from my own experience as the herbarium of the curator at Emory, we have to depend on philanthropy year to year to raise the funds necessary to keep this collection alive. So I would say, reach out to your local universities, see if they have an herbarium, see if you can help them. And if you'd like to help the work that we're doing at the Emory Herbarium, that's also greatly appreciated. In celebration of our 75th anniversary, we are doing our best to raise an endowment campaign. What does an endowment do? Basically, an endowment is an investment account. And if you can get a large enough endowment, which may yield around 5% per year, that can provide a stable source of income for a museum collection like an herbarium. So basically, if we could pull together a $1 million endowment, that would give us $50,000 to operate on every year. If we could get a $2 million endowment, that'd be $100,000 and so on. Our goal at the Emory Herbarium is to raise a $2 million endowment to secure the collection moving forward into the future. Without that, our collection, like Duke's, faces a certainty of closure and divestment. And that's a huge loss, not only for the research community in Atlanta. We are the only herbarium in Atlanta, in the metro city of Atlanta. So there's a huge loss to the scientists, to the educators. This specimen collection has been used in English departments, in environmental studies departments, biology departments. You know, it's been used in a lot of different courses. And students glean great value from understanding how species look, what the diversity of life looks like. And it also helps them get a better appreciation, understanding of where our medicines and foods come from. And that's just the beginning. As I mentioned, we're doing groundbreaking research on this collection that's leading us to discover new drugs for the future. So if you'd like to learn more about the Emory Herbarium, you can head over to herbarium.emory.edu. And on our website, we have lots of information about the composition of the collection and what we're doing to really try to prevent a future closure of our collection. We don't want to go the way of Stanford and Duke and lose this resource. That would be an incredible tragedy for the institution. So thank you all for listening. Again, I've written this article, this opinion piece came out in the Washington Post on March 20th. You can find it online. It'll be still available on there. And I welcome your comments and feedback. You can reach out to me on social media. You can reach out to me through my website at cassandraquave.com. let me know what your thoughts are. And if there are other ways or other things that you think you might be able to do to help us save this collection and others. Thanks so much for listening. Stay healthy out there, and I'll see you next time.